720 WGN, Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. Our next guest, I want to call him Coach. He has coached basketball for his entire life. And then one day he said, forget it, I'm going to start writing books. This is his fourth book. He'll be appearing at LitFest coming up in a few weeks. The book is entitled All the Dreams We've Dreamed. It's Russ Bradbird. It's great to see you. Thank you for coming in, Coach.
Thanks, Pete. Good to be here.
You know, you look at me and you say, wow, McMurray's a two guard. He's a shooter. I appreciate that.
I'd say point guard height, maybe, and point guard skills.
Why do people say that? I mean, I'm 5'10". I can shoot from the corner.
Enough. You're big enough.
This book isn't really a feel-good book. I mean, it's a very serious book.
That's right. All the Dreams We've Dreamed sort of chronicles the killings that have been going on around Marshall High School basketball, and it starts with the tragic mistaken identity shooting of Sean Harrington,
who we know from Hoop Dreams.
Yes, well, he had several cameo appearances in Hoop Dreams, but he was a well known basketball player, an all city basketball player, and a great college player. Went back to Marshall. That's part of the tragedy of the story. Is he did everything that society could ask a guy to do. He graduates from college, and comes back to make a difference. He's a good comes back to Chicago to be a good parent to his college, his high school girlfriend was pregnant after college. He comes back to be around the kids, helps to raise the kids. So he does everything society asks him to do, and he gets screwed.
And then, besides that tragedy, some of the players start getting killed.
Yes. So after Sean was shot in January of 2014, and then in succession, six players have been killed that had all played basketball for Marshall. And now, Pete, here's the real bomb, is that it appears, now I don't want to name someone, but it appears that another Marshall player was killed yesterday.
What?
So I don't want to say a name. It's all over Facebook, but I just don't feel like it's my place to.
Right.
So that would make the seventh Marshall basketball player, and they're just in a tragic spiral, and it's almost always been players that are done playing basketball.
I mean, you grew up with basketball your entire life, and you know the game, so you're writing from a basketball point of view, but you knew Sean. How did you know him?
Yes, well, I'd grown up in Chicago, as you know, and I was doing a scouting service in Chicago before I got hired at New Mexico State. So I'd seen him play quite a bit in high school, and then when I went to New Mexico State, as a recruiter, the first thing you need is who's going to be your point guard. So we went after Sean Harrington and got him. So I knew him from his days as a point guard at New Mexico State, and was completely out of touch with him. But then when I heard in 2003 his own mother was killed during a home invasion, a botched burglary attempt at the neighbor's house. She walked in just checking on the neighbors and walked into this horrific scene, ran out the door, but was killed on her way out the door. So he's been wrecked by gun violence.
Sure.
And so that's one of the remarkable things of the story is that, he's still been able to go forward and work, start these anti-gun initiatives using basketball. But it's a pretty disturbing story.
I mean, what compels a person to keep moving forward? I mean, when so many tragic events like that happen in your life.
Well, one of the things in the book, All the Dreams We've Dreamed, in the book, one of the things that the central themes of the book is the way Sean and I see the world differently. He sees God's hand in some of this, and it's something that he deals with on an everyday basis. And one of the amazing parts of the story was that when he's driving his daughter to school at 7 a.m. in this mistaken identity shooting,
and he was shielding his daughter.
Dives on top of his daughter.
And he gets shot.
A bullet goes through her headrest. I mean, can you imagine? Goes through her headrest, but he takes one in the back. And so he's paralyzed because just a really astonishing act of heroism. And I'd like to think, I'd do that. I have a daughter. I'd do that for my daughter. But would I do that when the bullets start flying? Would you do that when the bullets start flying? I don't think we really know until we're under that kind of pressure. And, for a long time,
I think it's a parental instinct to just shield your kids from anything.
I think that's a big part of it, but to think that quickly, to push her down, I think was pretty. But I also think part of it is you grew up around gun violence all the time.
Right, so you know.
And you're a little more seasoned. You don't panic the way maybe I might panic. I've never seen someone pull a gun and shoot it, other than television.
Right.
And so, I think
a lot of us are the same way.
Exactly. And so but that's what's remarkable about the story is his heroism in saving the daughter.
All the dreams we've dreamed. Russ Bradbird in studio with us. Arne Duncan, who was the former head of Chicago Public Schools and the former U.S. Secretary of Education of the United States, gave you a quote for this book.
Well, part of that's one of the interesting things about the book is that Arne Duncan, you know, we could not seem to get Sean Harrington's job redefined. See, Marshall's not wheelchair accessible. And people kept saying to me, well, you got to find Arne Duncan. He can help. And so, so I was calling all kinds of government agencies and well-to-do people that I knew or might have contact. But as it turned out, I could have got his phone number a year before through all the Chicago coaches have his number.
This is Chicago.
Yeah, right.
You're one person away from
exactly.
Arne Duncan's phone number. You can get Obama's phone number in about 30 minutes.
I know, but in the basketball community, everybody has Arne Duncan. It just didn't occur to me that all the coaches would have his number. So finally was able to get through to Arne Duncan. And so he's taken a strong interest in Sean's story and then provided the quote for the back of the book.
What compelled you to write this book?
This is
your fourth book.
Yeah, I could not stop. You know, at first I was advocating for Sean. It just drove me crazy. Here's a guy that is an American hero, and he did something that if it had happened in Iraq or Afghanistan, he's on the front of newspapers and magazines. He does it on the west side of Chicago, and I felt like it was being ignored. I think one of the things that happens, because I live in Chicago only in the summer, I'm not as immune to the violence as a lot of people are. And so at first I was advocating for him. And then I tried with the writer Alex Kotlowitz. I was saying, hey, Alex, you got to do a story on this guy. We'll get it in the New Yorker or the Wall Street Journal. And he finally said, Russ, you've been bugging me about this. Why don't you write it? And I thought, you know, I go to bed at night thinking about how can we help Sean Harrington? I wake up in the morning thinking, how can I help Sean Harrington? And I thought, screw it. You know, I'll try and write this one myself. So it was 3 years. The shooting happened 4 years ago, but the aftermath, as you can imagine, there's no getting over this.
No.
You know, the aftermath will go on forever.
So you had to spend some quality time with Sean.
Yes, because I'm in Chicago in the summers. I teach at New Mexico State. And
right.
So I was with him. I'm with him, you know, every few days in Chicago. I'm with him. So long interviews with him, long interviews with other people. And I should say he doesn't agree with everything in the book, which is part of the book, is that, you know, this different take on what went down and what happened and how things have evolved.
But you got to tell me, when a guy like this experiences so much tragedy in his life, what keeps him motivated? What keeps him going?
Well, that's what I don't know.
Because a lot of us would say, you know, that's it. I just can't do it anymore.
He has remarkable resilience, but it's also been very damaging to him. You know, it's one of the things that I'm concerned about is his day-to-day health. You know, it's one thing, you know, it's his day-to-day health and getting his exercise and getting his therapy. And now that he's been able to go back and start work at Marshall, but at one time, rehab was when his insurance ran out. Rehab was $850 a day. Now we can do fundraisers from now until
Kingdom
Come.
Isn't that ridiculous? That's just crazy.
Yeah, and how are we going to pay for $850 a day of rehab?
That drives me crazy. We saw a shooting Thursday at Dixon High School. We saw the shooting Friday in Santa Fe, the high school at Santa Fe in Texas, Parkland, Florida. What do we do? What is the next step? I don't think anybody has the answer, but we need to start moving towards something.
Pete, if you would have asked me 3 or 4 years ago, I had all the answers. But now that I've just been working on one guy's story in Marshall High School, one guy, Sean Harrington, one school, Marshall High School, I feel like I have less answers. You know, like I started off thinking, these damn police officers. Now, I saw that, you know, the cops caught Sean's shooters pretty quickly. And there used to be 120 murder detectives in Chicago, and now there's 80 of them. So, no, I get that the cops aren't perfect, but it's a complicated problem. One thing we could do is integrate the schools. I went to an integrated high school. I went to Von Steuben, which is an integrated high school. But the school system is segregated now, and there's a sort of an underbelly of, you know, there's the great schools. There's Whitney Young and Von Steuben and Lane Tech and that kind of thing. But there's also an underbelly of poorly performing schools.
Sure.
There's the charter schools that have devastated the public schools. So it's changed the neighborhoods, and the closing of schools has been a disaster. And so one of the things I've learned is an unsolved shooting really ruins a neighborhood. Can you imagine I know we live close to each other, where I'm at in the summer, we're not so far away. And can you imagine if in Old Irving Park or North Center or something like that, a shooting happened and it is just never solved. And another shooting happens and it's never solved. And last year, 95% of all the shootings went unsolved. Not all the murders, but all the shootings. And it's hard to fathom that all these guns are going off and no one is ever charged with anything.
Right.
And so, but it's complicated, and I'm wary of anyone who has a simple solution. So I decided in the book, in All the Dreams We Dreamed, I don't have any answers. I just present one person's story, and I think people will take it differently. I've gotten letters from military army guys saying how much they appreciated the story and Sean's heroism. Sure. But there's other people, there's peace activists, I think, that love the story as well. And I think that, you know, I think by only telling one person's story, I think I sort of enlarged the story.
When are you at LitFest?
Well, LitFest is Printers Row LitFest is June 9th and 10th. And Sean and I are going to appear with Rick Kogan, who I know you know.
I love Kogan.
He's a hero to so many of us. I'm sort of a journalist now.
Well, he's the Chicago treasure, first of all. He knows everybody in every single story, but that voice.
Yes, but what about, he's also Herman Kogan's son, if you know your history. But so we're appearing with Rick Kogan on Saturday, June 9th at 1 p.m. at Printer's Row. It's going to be Sean Harrington and myself and Rick Kogan, sort of a panel discussion about the book and about gun violence in Chicago.
I love this. I'm going to keep you around for another segment because I want to talk basketball, too.
I'm all yours.
Russ Bradbird is here. All the Dreams We've Dreamed. They can get the book just about anywhere, including Amazon. All right. It's 720 WGN. Is our phone number. Pete McMurray in the Allstate Showcase Studios. Our guest is Russ Bradbird. All the Dreams We've Dreamed is his fourth book, a story of hoops and handguns on Chicago's West Side. It is a story about basketball and guns and tragedy. It's a rough one.
Yes.
But it is Chicago's reality now, isn't it?
Yes, but also courage and endurance, I would say. I mean, there's not much uplifting about the book, Pete, except Sean Harrington's mindset, his personality, and the things that he's done. He started this Hoops for Peace Chicago tournament with a great player named Jimmy Sanders, a former retired player, and they do it. They're Hoops for Peace Chicago. Every player usually you go to a tournament and they give you a trophy. Or, mm-hmm. Like every player gets a book. Who's giving away books at tournaments? But they did voter registration, organ donor information, mm-hmm. and every player got a book at the tournament. It's just an odd idea. So their idea is to try to use sports as sort of this tool to as a lure, because basketball is so popular in the community,
right?
And if they can use it for voter registration and that kind of thing, the idea is it's a big positive.
Can you tell people about Sean that have never heard of him?
Well, Sean Harrington, he was, as you know, he played at Marshall and he appeared briefly in the Hoop Dreams movie. A lot of cameos. He didn't have a starring role, but he was I think he was a sophomore in the final culmination, the final year of the film, but. And he went on, played at New Mexico State and then Northwest Missouri State, got his degree before the tragedy, before he was shot. And part of the amazing part of the story is that he was not a teacher. He was a educational support personnel, essentially a teacher's aide in special ed. So he had this magical touch with the kids. There's a story in the book about no one could reach this autistic kid, but yet Sean was able to, even though Sean hadn't been trained to work with autistic kids,
right,
and had never met an autistic kid, but here's an autistic kid, go try and talk to that kid. And within a year, Sean had sort of got him out of his shell and convinced him to run, are you ready for this, for Homecoming King, a kid who just sits in the corner all day, a year before wasn't even speaking to anybody.
I love that.
Runs for Homecoming King.
I love it.
Rallies the students to vote for him, and then convinces the star of the Sean convinced the star of the boys' basketball team to back off and don't tell your friends to vote for you. And then so this kid winds up winning. The autistic kid wins Homecoming. Just changes his life. And so Sean had this magic touch, I think, with people where he was able to get to people, for teachers and students and other. And one of, so there's that kind of charisma where the janitors love him, but the principal loves him as well. And Arnie Duncan loves him, but the kids on the street love him. I mean, he's got that kind of personality and that kind of charm that he can talk in a lot of different languages.
It takes a special person to be a coach and a teacher. I really believe that. And, Sean has that gift. There is some type of connection or some type of drive that these people have.
Yes, but I will also say that his empathy and his sympathy for the downtrodden kids at Marshall and the hard luck stories and that kind of thing, I think all that's great and hugely important, but there's a danger to that too, because I think it really, there's been six kids killed, maybe seven as of last night. Six of his players have been killed, and I think it really, a more callous guy would react differently.
Right.
So there is sort of that danger I think it's true for all of us, Pete. His strength could also be his weakness if he's not careful, and we're all like that a little bit.
Right.
And so what makes us good at something can sometimes be our undoing. Very sort of, is that Shakespeare? I don't know. I should know. I'm an English professor. That's very
Shakespearean. You're the teacher. I'm just a radio host.
But that's part of the story of all the dreams we've dreamed. In the book, it talks about that quite a bit. Is that you know, his compassion and empathy, but also, you know, there's a danger to that. As kids keep getting shot, you know, it keeps, like, he doesn't go to the funerals anymore.
Yeah, I mean, I hate the fact that we're used to it in Chicago. I mean, on average, what is it, 20, 25 shootings a weekend?
Yes.
And we're used to it, and it's not even summertime yet.
I've had school administrators tell me that Sean Harrington's story is a good story because he lived. Well, that was very upsetting to me to hear the idea that this is a positive story and a real story, and I mean, a positive story, and that somehow it was some kind of happy ending because he was alive.
There's no happy ending.
Yeah, and I think we've become a little bit immune to it, and it just has to stop.
Russ Bradbird in studio. All the Dreams We've Dreamed is the name of his book. You've been a coach for how many years? I know you're retired now.
Well, I'm not quite old enough to be retired, but I coached in college Division I basketball for 14 seasons, 8 years at UTEP, the University of Texas, El Paso, where I worked for Don Haskins, the sort of the famous coach from the Glory Road kind of movie and that kind of thing. And it was actually Tim Floyd who talked Don Haskins into hiring me. Tim was an assistant coach down there. So I was there for 8 years and then at New Mexico State for six. And then in the Irish Super League, which is the lowest level of pro basketball in the world.
Wait a second. But, that sounds like a made-up Chicago league.
I was
the Irish Super League.
Well, there it was. So I was, which is, that's my first, the first book, Patty on the Hardwood, was about my time coaching.
Sponsored by Cork and Kerry.
There it is. Uh-huh. But I coached my team into last place in the Irish Super League. So that was my first book. But so there's 14 years. And then I decided I want to try and write, you know, I want to try and write and be a writer. I always loved books. And it started for me, Pete, with the Sports Illustrated Book Club. You know, they used to have this book club where they sent you books. So the first book I got was David Megacy's book. Do you remember this book? It's called Out of Their League, and he had quit pro football to work against the Vietnam War, and it made a big impression on me. Like, he had been on the St. Louis football Cardinals, you know, and he quit pro football at the height of his career, and I thought, well, that's an interesting. And so right away, I had this idea that sports was not just about the games. And then working for Don Haskins, who started the first five black players to win a national championship. And so I got, you know, and then worked on did the Nolan Richardson book, and he was very political and outspoken. And so I've had this idea for a while about sports as this agent for social change and also this barometer. You know, if you think about it, the greatest voice for peace in American history was Martin Luther King. You wouldn't get much debate about that. He came out against the Vietnam War in 1967, but Muhammad Ali had done it a year earlier.
Right.
And that was when things started to shift in the American consciousness. Kids started protesting the Vietnam War, and now there's more conscientious objectors. And so, and even Jackie Robinson desegregated Major League Baseball in 1947, but it wasn't until 1949 that the U.S. military did. So baseball was the leader. And so that's often been the case, especially in racial progress and gender stuff. Mm-hmm. It's often been sports at the forefront.
When did you graduate from high school?
I can't remember. It was a long time ago. 1976.
1976.
The bicentennial class.
That's right.
There it is.
I went to Bradley University. Coach Versace was there. He had the best record in college basketball in 1986. 32 and 3.
Yeah, something going into the playoffs, yes.
They win their first game in the tournament. They lose to Louisville, and Louisville goes on to win the national championship. And, of course, Coach Baroni was there.
Yes.
What is your connection with those two? Because you know those guys.
Well, I went and worked at their camp. And we're talking about this connection between sports and books and literature and art. And, you know, for me, Dick Versace was really a very early model. Like, he was interested in theater and movies and books and politics. And he was just a very much sort of broader kind of, he had a much broader view of the world. And
he ran down in central Illinois.
Well, that was a step backwards in my opinion, but running for political, I'm joking, but he was really a model in some ways. And he was very different than Tony Baroni. You know, Tony was basketball.
Oh, yeah.
And Dick was very much, you know, saw it sort of as part of a bigger story in the wider world and the human condition and that kind of thing. But I found that very inspiring and very interesting. That here was a guy who didn't eat, sleep, and drink basketball every minute and was still a successful coach.
Right. I mean, I loved the Missouri Valley back in the day. You had Bradley, ISU, of course, the war on 74, Wichita State with Xavier McDaniel.
Sure.
He went to Wichita State. And Tulsa, coached by Nolan Richardson, and you wrote a book on him.
Yeah, the book 40 Minutes of Hell. It actually got turned into an ESPN 30 for 30. And so, but I found Nolan to be, you know, I just thought, well, here's a Nolan Richardson. I saw him to be a guy that's a political figure first. And so when I approached Nolan and I said,
very political.
Yeah, I said that if you want someone to write a book like they would about Lute Olson, Lute Olson or Jim Calhoun or Rick Pitino, I'm not the guy, but I try, I, convinced him of, and I, not that he had needed much convincing, but that I thought his place was as a political figure. I would say the same thing about Dorothy Gators, the great Marshall girls coaches. She's won over 1,000 games. She's the greatest, maybe one of the greatest coaches in American history, regardless of gender or sport. But I see her as a political, sort of a symbol of political and social progress. And when she took over at Marshall, they had 4 games a year. And now she's won 1,000 games. Like, it was a club. Jeez. It was a club sport. And so I'm very interested in the. I could tell you a lot of Don Haskins stories and Nolan Richardson stories. I can't recall any of the plays that we used to run, or the winning baskets, or the score. I just never found that stuff as interesting. But it was the stories behind all that.
Nolan Richardson was one of those coaches that was bigger than life.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And Don Haskins too. And I think that's where we're headed with Sean Harrington. I've talked to Sean about this, is that his life now stands for something greater than you played at Marshall and now you coach at Marshall. Now his life, you know, it's true in a lot of aspects of, you know, whether it's Abe Lincoln or Martin Luther King, mm-hmm. and now Sean Harrington comes along, and his life means a lot more than what might look like at first glance.
You coach D1 basketball. I love seeing the mid-majors in the tournaments. What do you think of college basketball today? Are there too many powerhouses like the Dukes of the world?
No, I was delighted that, you know, of course, for Loyola's great success.
How great was that?
Yeah, and so I was delighted for that, and I think just the sort of the, if you lose a game, you're out of it, then anything can happen in a single game. So I think in general it's not in terrible shape, but for me the conundrum is it's free market capitalism for the coaches, and for the players it's amateur sports. And I think it's just, I don't know how they can continue doing things both ways, where I know at New Mexico State, if you send your kid to New Mexico State, Pete, they're not even going to meet a professor till they're a junior. They're going to get taught by adjuncts and instructors and people who don't have health insurance, and then when you're a junior you get a professor. That's true at nearly every major American university, is that the coach is making $5 million a year and your kid is being taught by a $25,000 a year adjunct. That's a bad system. And now that I'm on the other side of things, I'm on the academic side of things, I see the danger in that. Like, it doesn't make sense to me that not just that the players at Louisville don't get paid, but that the English instructors at Louisville, or the, you know, intro to history instructors are not making a livable wage.
Well, that's happened for years, that teachers don't make enough money.
Yes, that's right.
That's the problem.
But now that I'm on the academic side of things, and I've seen the now New Mexico State's actually in fairly sane. Our coach only makes $400,000 a year or something like that. But there's something wrong with the system.
I mean, which is insane money just to coach basketball, if you think about it.
That's right. But he's one of the lower paid major right. coaches in America. So that idea that it's a free market for the coach. Mm-hmm. You know, like I teach writing classes now, and if one of my students had a best selling novel, we wouldn't say, you can't keep that money now, you're an amateur. I mean, it's a funny thing to do. I think it's a funny thing to do. And of course, the dynamic is complicated because of race, is that, you know, most of the players are black. And so I don't like the slavery analogy that the Duke mother said. I think that's too much of a hot button thing to say, that it's just like slavery when you're, you know, getting a $70,000 scholarship to Duke and 10 pairs of gym shoes a year and that kind of thing. But
you're getting everything free.
But a whole industry has sprung up on the backs of these kids.
Where sure.
There's people who have made have a lifetime career, and the players get 3 or 4
years. And now you have sports betting, which is going to be legal in every single state.
Makes me cringe.
Yeah.
That makes me cringe.
I love this town. I love that we're an amateur sports town. I love watching high school basketball. I just love it. I watch high school football, but high school basketball, I love it. I've become friends with Tommy Kleinschmidt over the years, and it's so much fun to follow them around and watch their games, you know?
Well, you should have saw him play. He was a great player.
Oh, he still has the shot.
Oh, is that,
I challenge him all the time. I go one-on-one, full court, because he can't run anymore.
I'll bet. I've said for years, my favorite thing to do, when I lived in Chicago for many years, of course, and I would, when I was doing my scouting service, I'd go to, there's some public league games start at 3:15, and some start at 4:30, and then there's the night games in the suburbs or the Catholic League. So you could see 3 games a day on a lot of days, on, you know, on Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, you could see 3 games in a day. And that was really great. And I would just as soon go to a good high school basketball game in Chicago. It's the great, I mean, the cheerleaders are so soulful and the players are so intense, and it's just
God, there's so much passion in the crowd.
And I think now that I'm a writer, Pete, every game is a story. Here's the beginning of the story, here's the middle of the story, here's the end of the story. And so there's a big analogy with the beginning beginning, middle, and end that happens, and the drama and the players and the ups and downs that I still find very compelling.
I mean, there's a reason that Coach K comes here every year and plucks kids out of, you know, the inner city.
That's right. And, right. Yeah, let's not forget, he's a, you know, a Chicago, you know, hard-scrabble
kid. Sure, he went to Weber High School.
Yeah, in Wicker Park before it was, you know, when you could still afford it.
He comes back every single summer and sees his brother, who's a retired fire chief.
I didn't know.
Yeah, every single summer he's
back
here.
He never looks me up.
I've seen him once in the last 10 years, yeah. And I begged him for an interview.
No, I've never met him.
It's great to see you.
Yeah, good, thanks, Pete.
So you're going to be at LitFest again? Can you mention to people when you're going to be there?
It's June 9th at the Printer's Row Lit Festival, June 9th at 1 p.m. with Rick Kogan and Sean Harrington. But there's a couple smaller ones before that. May 30th at the Bookseller. Seller is C-E-L-L-A-R. The Bookseller on Lincoln near Lawrence. That's on Tuesday, May 29th at 6 p.m. And then City Lit, which is a great bookstore in Logan Square. Mm-hmm. That's on Wednesday, June 6th. And Sean Harrington will be at all three of those events. So you might not want to meet a hack writer like myself, but to meet somebody like
Sean.
I'm not kidding now. To meet Sean Harrington, it's really has a real charisma and power that people need to interact with.
For people that know high school basketball, I mean, he was a name. I was talking to Ronnie Fields the other day, who trains kids.
Sure.
And talk about a guy. That's another story.
Yes, and somebody should be writing that book. I'm not the guy to do it, but somebody should be writing the Ronnie Fields. You know, it's a pretty good documentary.
Because he was destined for the NBA, and
yes.
Then he gets in a car crash and breaks his neck,
yes.
And that was it.
Yes.
It was over.
He may have been the best high school player ever. I know people say Ben Wilson, but Ronnie Fields, I think, was right up.
Right.
He was a sensational leaper. I've never met Ronnie Fields, but I admired his game, and his high school coach, Wolf Nelson. Is Farragut and Wolf Nelson are an important part of this book, the new book.
We could talk for another 45 minutes,
right,
but I got to let you go. I got to give a shout out to Jack Silver, a mutual friend of ours. Jack grew up in Chicago. You went to school together, and Jack was in radio, who I met years and years ago, and he's never hired me, ever.
Well,
you need to talk to him
lucky.
About it.
Oh, no, you want to be hired by him.
Well, no, probably not.
No. Now, Jack's a dear friend, and he's the guy who introduced me to basketball back in sixth grade.
Really?
Yeah.
Jack doesn't have basketball skills.
Oh, he was the best sixth grade player in the city. But he had hair down to the middle of his back,
and he hasn't grown since.
Hair down to the middle of his back, and I think he liked the rock and roll music better. But he was a very good player, and played at Von Steuben. He wasn't a great player at Von Steuben, but he was the best sixth grade player I've ever seen. I mean, he could shoot a lefty layup. Who can shoot a lefty layup in sixth grade?
We were all great grammar school basketball players. Russ Bradbird, all the dreams we've dreamed. Really appreciate you coming in.
Thanks, Pete.
It's 720 WGN.